So you can't take it personal if I don't ask your question. Okay? Even if I know who wrote it. The first question, I guess, is a general question. It's related to some of the other questions. But are Q&A sessions binding?
No. It's anytime you ask questions in this type of setting, you're hearing someone's opinion, and you can take it for what it's worth. If you have enough reason to trust the person's opinion, then I guess it has value. If you don't trust it, then it doesn't have much value. But it's certainly not binding in a sense of a psak halacha. It's whatever is the value of, I guess, hearing from whatever the stature of the person answering is, I wouldn't use the word binding. It's a question of, I will call it using your seichel. If a person goes, imagine you would have a question and answer session with the top doctors in a particular field, and you would ask them questions obviously related to their field, and they would tell you their opinions. And somebody would ask, are these binding? They would say, what do you mean binding? You would like to know what the experts say. So then if you consider them the experts, then the seichel says, listen to them. If you don't think they're experts, then fine. So that's just the mushel. I'm not comparing it to myself. I'm not an expert. But I'm just saying, when you have questions and answers, you like to hear that person's understanding of things. So obviously you have some reason to believe that he has what to offer.
Okay. What should a Ben Torah think about Israeli settler violence against Palestinians?
I would say, just first of all, as a hakadama, as a preface, I feel that in general, whenever you're discussing, analyzing, critiquing what's going on in a different country, even a different city, there's something really, I think, inappropriate to really critique and analyze, because if you're not there, you can't really have the full story. You can't have the full understanding of it. Thank you very much. So anytime somebody is saying an opinion about what's going on in a different community, a different city, and certainly a different country with a different culture and a different history, you're superimposing your life's experience, where you are, onto that setting and saying an opinion. So Bichlal, I don't think it's appropriate to really critique. Now, but in order to perhaps just appreciate what it is, and I'm not going to say my opinion. I mean, obviously there's going to be some criticism in what I'm saying, but I'm saying it with this context. If somebody were to tell you there's a particular city where there's a lot of tension between two segments of the population, whether it's Yidden, Goyim, between Yidden, whatever it may be, there's tension. And I ask, well, what's the tension about? And there's a history, whether they're fighting over something important, something unimportant, whether I look at them as a bunch of gangsters, or I look at them as people who are passionate about things that are important, but there's a history, and that creates a tension. Whenever people act, we'll call it they act out, wherever people act in a way that's not the norm, there's obviously something there that's off. Now, you'll hear plenty of stories in the news of a person who shot an intruder. Was he provoked? Did he have to shoot? Did he have to kill him? Was the person coming armed? Was he frightened? That's the details that change the story. So I hear the story, and this person shot somebody and killed him. I'd say he's a murderer. Well, maybe it was self-defense. Maybe the other person threatened to kill him, and it was self-defense. So the details change the story from which one is the hero and which one is the victim. Which one's the hero, which one is the aggressor. Now, Eretz Yisrael is a country where there's a tremendous amount of tension, because we all know that the Jews that are living there are under attack constantly from the Arab, we'll call them neighbors. I mean, they're there. Now, I'm not saying anything about are there certain things that provoke this one provokes that. I'm not saying anything because I'm not there. And every story has two sides. But the reality, put yourself in the minds of people living in a place where they know that there are people who would like to kill them. I'm not saying that they attempted at this moment, but that's certainly their mentality. When I live in a place where I know that I'm surrounded by people that hate me, I'm automatically on the defensive. I'm automatically going to perceive things that are done in a certain way, whether I am right in each particular moment or not, but that's certainly my perception. And you can't fault a person for that, because the person is living constantly with the threat and the fear of being attacked and being hurt. So any given incident, you can always isolate it and say, well, let's see who started. You know, it's like you have kids get into a scuffle, and you come over and say, who started? And the response usually is, well, he hit me. But the, what you'd really like to know is, did you hit him first? Or did you say something insulting? So you, it's not really an answer to say, well, he hit me and therefore I hit him back. Because why did he hit you? Maybe because you took away his toy. So every story has a beginning. To take an episode in isolation is also, I think, very often missing the beginning. So again, I can't comment on what these people are doing, because in my mind, any violence is terrible. When a person is doing something in self-defense, he has no choice. That he has no prayer, he has to do what he has to do. Can you define self-defense? Are there times when people seem to go on the offensive and they will claim this is to preempt? The answer is yes. Is it always accurate? It depends on the circumstance. There are plenty of situations where there are preemptive strikes where the one side will say they're the aggressor, and the other ones will say, this is self-defense. So the things that go on over there, besides the details, which you certainly cannot trust the media for the details, because it's pashut, they have the way they present things. Even if I would know the details, I don't know if I would feel that I have the full story, because I don't believe the story starts with the incident. So my answer is that there are always situations where people do things they shouldn't be doing. There can even be situations where they may have a right to do what they're doing and it's still wrong, because the repercussions may be worse. They may be endangering other people. There's so many cheshbonos, and I can't fault people for sometimes having tunnel vision when they deal with things, because when they look at the broader picture, maybe they're endangering others. Maybe this will cause other things to happen. I don't know how I would be in that situation, because it's emotional, people are passionate, people are frightened. So I'm on the sidelines, I'm not gonna criticize them. It's obviously not something that I would cheer, but I would be hesitant to say criticism.
Okay, as always, although I have questions over here, if you feel there's something that needs further clarification, feel free to ask. Yeah.
How does that differ from calling out violence on the Arab side? Where we're pretty clear about
From what?
How does it differ from calling out violence from the Arabs? Meaning saying they're aggressing.
Well, what I would say is like this. Again, what the media says, I think we all know that we can't trust. The Arabs do not hide their animosity for the Israelis. All of their teachings, which they don't hide, and anybody who reads their publications amongst themselves, they are calling for the destruction of Israel, at least of the Jewish people. They're not hiding that. Most Israelis are not calling for the destruction of the Arabs. So without getting into all the details of what goes on, that already creates a very different picture from the two sides. They're not making believe. They may present a picture of being the oppressed, et cetera, with all that's presented, but it is part of their ideology that they should be, and that's how they're training their children. They don't hide that. They train their children that their, I would maybe even mission in life, is to kill as many Jews as you can. That they say openly. The Israelis don't do that. They're not training, they're training their children to become aggressors. They're training them in self-defense because they live in that environment. So I think that already sets the stage of a different perspective of one than the other.
Okay, in a small community with limited resources, if a kol is started, which is encouraging mechanchim to learn in the afternoon, and accidentally or otherwise draws them away from their opportunities to tutor due to this schedule, can Balabatim legitimately argue that this is not meeting the community's needs?
I don't know all the details of the question, but I would say like this. If a community hired people to come to the community and their job description is be available for the community needs of teaching, tutoring, etc., and that's their job description, and they're getting paid in a way that they can live without having to supplement their income, then they have a right to say, we brought you in for this purpose. Generally in communities, I don't know if that happens, you'll have people in communities who are brought in either by an institution, by a school, or you can have people who live in a community and they end up taking jobs in schools. So this is their parnasa, and they're servicing the community by the filling positions that they fill. There are always needs in communities to have to supplement what school is not enough. Many children need outside help, and you need the manpower of people to hire to do that. So you have to look for people who are willing and able to do that. The fact that you have people who are mechanchim in a city and they're teaching in the schools does not mean that, number one, they are the community's hire for everything the community needs. Everybody has to be a team player in the sense, if I live in a community and there are needs and I can be helpful, then of course people should be willing to help. That's true for everyone, regardless of what their occupation is. But in terms of the community having a taina to say that it's inappropriate for these mechanchim to either learn or learn as a kollel, which they need for themselves. They need it for themselves as people. Very often they need it to supplement their income, which is not enough for them, their mishpachos. So to say to them that you're bound to be available for the other needs of the community, they are as bound as everybody else in the community. The entire community has to should be willing to help where they could help. I don't think that it's limited to dafka the mechanchim who can help, but as far as the way the question is being posed, the mechanchim are the mechanchim, so they're hired by the schools. So they're hired by the schools. That's their shibud.
What about like a parent who has, let's say, the son's learning with a rabbi, and then he just like, and this kid needs the help, and he lost his tutor, his kid's struggling, and doesn't have anything.
Right.
In that angle.
So they have to find someone to tutor their child. I'm saying if you went to somebody who think is the most qualified to tutor your child and he has another job, so would you say to him, give up that job? What if the mechanech took a job, not a mechanech in Kail, he took another job to supplement his income. He was selling something out of his basement to supplement his income, so he has a small business because he can't make ends meet from the salary he's getting as a mechanech. So would you come to him and say, you should close your business because I need someone to tutor my child? The mechanech would say, well, if you can match what comes in from my little business, that's fine. But I have to take care of my family. That's from the financial part of it. If you had somebody who was living in town, who is sitting and learning, and someone would come to him and say, I need someone to learn with my child. Does he have an obligation to tutor that child? It's a good question, but that's a question that could be asked to the community across the board. You can go to any shul or beis medrash in the community, and you'll find a person who's learning. I don't know what he does for what his profession is. He happens to be in a beis medrash learning and say to him, I need someone to learn with my child. The parent can certainly approach the person, and again, the person has to make a judgment whether or not, assuming he's qualified, is something he should be doing. But I don't see why the mechanchim are the ones who are being targeted more than anybody else. They should be willing to help wherever they can, like everybody else in the community.
Is it wrong for the Balabatim to be frustrated enough to stop supporting that girl?
Not necessarily be frustrated or asked to support it, and it's detrimental.
If it's a good thing, it should be supported. A mechanchen koyel means your mechanchem are learning. There's more liman atayr in the community. It's good for the mechanchem. They'll be better mechanchem because they're learning. It's good for everybody, so why should it not be supported? Because I have a need because my child needs somebody. The person I'd like to do it happens to be occupied with something else. So,
I guess that would connect to a different question. If I feel a special connection to a certain type of tzedakah, for example, special needs, does that give it priority over other causes? Which would relate to this question. Where does it fall within the hierarchy of tzedakah priorities?
Okay. I'm not sure if the connection is connected. The question is connected. But the Shulchan Aruch tells us the priorities of what we should do with our tzedakah money. In every community, the community has to take care of the community needs. So as a community, there has to be a sense of achrayus to all that the community needs. An individual person who's making his own calculations of how much am I giving and how should I give it, there is a seder of kedima, of chashivas, to certain things over other things. If a person feels a pull to a particular need, a certain cause, it's a koshera negias, it doesn't make it necessarily more chashiv, but if that's what he feels pulled to, you know, he has a right to give his money there. But in the if one were to ask what has, I'm not sure if the right term is a better investment or more chashiv investment, there is a certain chashivus in the way Chazal set up the Seder of Kedim or Futzdaka. But if a person has a pull for it, I wouldn't call it a Yetzer Hara. he may have an emotional pull, which is, it's fine, but he certainly should not look at this as a reason to neglect the others. The others are not less chashuv because of that. It doesn't define the chashivas.
Yeah.
A
lot of institutions make money, so most of them, my personal institutions, I feel sometimes that the impact that could have on individual needs that come to me, or the needs of individuals who come to me, would be more limited because I'm committed to institutions. How does that, how should one divide that institutional position?
Generally, the institutions, again, there are different types of institutions. If you're talking about local institutions, is the responsibility of the community to take care of. It's also responsibility to take care of the people in town who are needy, whatever their needs are. But the institutions are a communal need, and the community cannot function without these institutions generally. You can have different organizations that exist, but if you're talking about the institutions that are needed for the community to function as a community, they are definitely a priority because it impacts everyone. In a more global sense, when you have institutions that are national or international, they also service the entire nation. If a person were to say, we have Rabbanim in town, we have Mechanchim in town, who produced them? They were produced in their respective yeshivas and kollelim where they learned. So as much as there's a responsibility on local institutions, which generally are, we'll call it younger children as far as the educational system, but there are also institutions which provide for the communities at large the manpower that they need for those communities, so everybody benefits from those larger communities. So the institutions that are local are definitely a priority. The institutions that service the klal, every community benefits from. Everybody either has the benefit of talmidim of those institutions, their children might have learned in those institutions, they themselves might have learned in those institutions. They service klal yisrael in a broader sense. I can't tell you dollar for dollar. Everybody has it, and as the Gemara says that Eina bar mismala micho yosai, when the needs are greater than the resources. So I can't tell people, you know, there's enough money in every community to take care of all the needs. We generally feel squeezed. But the achrayus is there for both the institutions recognizing that these are the vital organs of the community, and every individual has to be cared for. That's a communal effort. Now, how they're helped, the details, I don't think is part of this discussion, but I think the achrayus has to be shared. So people have to feel the achrayus. I can't tell you how to divide up your money, but the institutions, I think, are the vital organs of the community. That's a very good question. The Rambam writes that a person should give more times because that way he's doing the Maisa mitzvah more often. That's what the Rambam writes. So that's true in general. However, if you're trying to help either an institution or even a needy person, for example, a person comes and says, I can't make a mortgage payment. I'm going to lose my house. And my mortgage payment is X amount of dollars. I can't say to him, well, you can come back to me for the next month every day and I'll give you a few dollars. I have to make the payment today. So the situation doesn't always lend itself to using this formula. You have an institution that has to make payroll. So they have to make payroll. You can't tell their employees there's going to be money coming in drips and drabs, and by the end of next month, you'll get your paycheck. So In principle, your question's a very good question, that there's a milah, the ma'aseh mitzvah for every individual person. But practically speaking, you have to see, you're trying to help the person, the institution, whatever it may be, with what their needs are. It's not always practical to do it in a way that it's not a lump sum.
Okay, how much should a teenager be taught about proofs of Judaism and Hashem's existence versus emunah pshuta?
Versus?
Emunah pshuta.
We teach our children from the time they start to speak. One could say that we're brainwashing them. We teach them from the time that they can speak, almost before they can think, the principles of our emunah. The Ramban writes, the strength of our emunah is because we trust our parents. The Ramban says, a parent does not lie to his children. The strength of each person's emunah is the trust. The strength is not because he was convinced. It's because we have a Messiah, which means we trust. I trust my parents that I'm Jewish. I trust my parents that they're my parents. I have no doubt. I trust them. I didn't see necessarily the documentation, but I trust them. We live on trust. Klal Yisrael's existence is based on trust. There's a mitzvah for a person to understand as much as possible about what we believe. So there's a mitzvah to be mekabel the emunah, and that's the strength of the emunah, but there's also a mitzvah to understand as much as it's possible to understand. But the strength of it, of the commitment, people, Yidden, gave up their lives to be Yidden because of their trust that this is right, not because of the intellectual conclusion. When you're dealing with children, any age, you're trying to educate them as much as possible. We educate our children. We teach them emunah when we teach them chumash. We teach them emunah by the way we talk and act. We teach them about the Avos, Moshe Rabbeinu, Matan Torah. This is what we transmit to them. This is our belief. If children have questions, we have to answer them. They should never feel that questions are off limits. If they have questions, we should deal with them. They should never feel inhibited that I'm not supposed to ask questions. Sometimes I don't know the answer to my child's question, so I try to bring him to someone who can help him. You can sometimes have questions where the child is just being fed questions that are not his questions. That becomes a little bit more challenging. If the child has questions and needs to know the answers, work with the child, teach them what's age appropriate. Sometimes when you introduce questions, you leave them with the question and they don't always appreciate the answer. So it's not always a mila to feed them questions. When you teach them, and we're always prodding and encouraging our children to think, and we want them to think. Imagine you learn a piece of Gemara. You're trying to get the Talmidim to be mechaven to Tosfos's kasha, to be mechaven to a kasha from somebody. You're trying to push them to think to the point that they recognize there's something here that needs explanation. So we want to prod our children to be thinkers. We don't want them to be simpletons, you know, brainless. We want them to think. We want them to understand what they learn. We want them to think and ask questions, trying to understand, as long as the motivation of the question is trying to understand, not to be challenging, not to just simply mehechatesi. There's no ta'elus in that. If the child doesn't want to be mekabel, you won't get anywhere. Giving him questions prematurely is not necessarily a mila. Teaching him what we believe is a mila. As they ask, encourage the questions, work with the child, but it has to be age appropriate and has to be really coming from the child.
How do I teach my children about money and living within their means without causing them to obsess over money? What is the right age to begin this education? What if I myself haven't fully figured out the balance yet? And in the same topic, what is the halachic view on saving for retirement? Can one save too much?
A person's perspective on money, which is really a person's perspective on anything in life, is that whatever I have is what the Rabbanu Shlomo gives me. He gives me life, he gives me health, and he gives me what I need to maintain myself. The way I get the things that I need are not always dropped at my front door. The Yidden in the Midbar ate the man. They were tzaddikim that had delivery to their doorstep. And there were people that were not such big tzaddikim, and they had to be matriach to go get the man. So they all had man, but whether or not they had to be matriach and work harder to get it depended on the madrega of the person. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, post Adam Harishon's chet, we're put us in a situation of Bezeyas Apecha Toichalechem, Koit Vedardar Tatsmiach Loch. Kadosh Baruch Hu did not put us in a Gan Eden setting after the Chet of Adam Harishayim. The Yidden in the Midbar was a short time period as a preparation Klal Yisrael needed at that time, but otherwise we live with being Matriach, being Mishtadal to take care of ourselves. If the person understands whatever I have is what Hashem wants me to have, if he really believes it, it should help him not become obsessed, because it's not going to help. Because whatever Hashem wants me to have, I'll have. What if he doesn't want me to have? If he lets me have it, it'll end up hurting me. If he lets me have it, I'll end up losing it. It'll only bring with it agmas nefesh. So if a person's perspective is what I'm supposed to have, I'll have, as long as he's not a pesheya, a person can't just lie in bed and say, Hashem knows my mailing address, he can just mail me the check. That's the same person who's waiting for the mun on his doorstep, and he gets a tap on the shoulder, your mun is a few parsa down, you can walk and get it. You don't want to pick it up, you'll go hungry. Hashem doesn't say, I'm going to treat you like a tzaddik when you're not. If a person has the schus that he doesn't have to work as hard, it's a schus. How will I know if I have that schus? Well, if I get what I need, then I have the schus. If I don't, I guess I don't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to be mishtadl as much as I'm mishtadl. Obsessing is never a mila in anything. It's always unhealthy, but I'm not a professional, but certainly when it comes to obsessing about money, it comes with the notion that there's something I can do about it. Children learn from their parents. Children's perspective on most things in life is what they saw from their parents. Now, it's not 100% true, because children are also exposed to classmates, other families, and therefore their exposure can also have a hashpah on them, so they're not being raised in a bubble, so it's not always what goes on at home. But a major impact on a child's perspective in life, and many aspects in life, and certainly money, is the way he sees his parents deal with it. If he sees his parents are obsessed, he will either become obsessed or he'll run the other direction because he can't stand the way his parents are. So that's the impact that parents have on their children. If the children embrace what their parents are doing, that becomes their way of living. If they can't stand it because it's something they find hard to be soivo, they'll run the other way. Very often, children in this regard become used to the way their parents live and the way memela the children live. A person has to be careful. I often tell Talmidim of mine, these are b- Bachrim in their 20s. You're going to become newlyweds. Some of them come from affluent homes. I say it's very possible that when your parents got married, they had a card table and some folding chairs as their dining room set. By the time you came on the scene, and by the time you had enough seichel to know what's going on around you, and you lived in a very nice furnished home, you never saw the first chapter in your parents' home. Your parents didn't always live like this. But for these children, this may be the starting point of how they build their home. So very often you have children who grow up in homes, and when they get married, their expectations are such that I'm not starting in the basement. I'm not starting even on the ground floor. I'm already starting where my parents are holding today. So it's a very tricky thing. You don't want children to feel that the parents are stingy and the parents don't want to spend money on them. You don't want to give that impression either. That's not healthy. Children have to feel they're taken care of. Your needs are met. It's important that the attitude of the parents does not come across as being stingy and tight. But there's the difference between stingy and tight and being responsible. So parents have to be there to take care of their children, the children to feel they're taken care of. There's always a whole, I don't know if it's one of the questions on the list, but it's a common question. You know, your child comes home and says, everybody has this, that, and the other. Can I have it? And of course, not everyone has it. That's just the nusach. And then enough kids tell it to their parents that enough kids have it that now you can truly say everybody has it. Okay, that's a parent pressure. That's a different topic, which is not easy to answer. But if you're just talking about your own home, people have to realize their children reflect what they see from the parents' attitude more than what they actually hear from the parents. My parent will say to me, be careful with how you spend money, and then I just watch how they spend. Actions speak louder.
Can a ben Torah have non-learning related hobbies to relax? What would the criteria be for such?
What?
I'm sorry? Can you save too much for retirement?
Okay, fine. I am not a financial advisor. I would say people have to live their lives like a mensch. As you can imagine a person who doesn't want to spend a dime on himself because he's busy saving. He is the biggest victim because he's living his life like a pauper. Because he's saving all of his money, all of his earnings, because when I retire, so then things will be great. He has no idea whether he'll make it to retirement, what shape he'll be in retirement, whether he'll be able to enjoy it. I once heard this, Reb David Karlina was a Gadol Hador. He was right after Reb Akiva Eiger. So his wife once said the following expression. I'll say it in Yiddish, which is the way she said it, which has more geschmack, and then I'll translate. She said, "Wenn wir haben gehad Zähner, when we had teeth, wir haben nicht gehad kein Brot." That means the early Rabbanus of my husband, we had teeth, we were young, but we had no bread. Today, my husband is a big Rav, wir haben Brot, wir haben nicht Zähner. Today, my husband is a big Rav, so we have plenty of bread, but we don't have any teeth because we're older, we're old people. So sometimes a person thinks to himself, I'm a 25-year-old, 30-year-old, I'll always be like this, even when I'm 60 years old. I'll be in the same shape, same energy, and then I'll enjoy my money when I don't have to work. Life doesn't always work like that. A person has to live his life. Does a person have to think about the future? The answer is yes. How far in the future? So there are two levels. The Chazon Ish speaks about this in a letter about what he considers, he calls it the Oser HaHayve, we'll call it the near future. I have my children, I have anticipated expenses. A person has to think about it. if it's something within a few years. A person thinks to himself, but what about 25, 30 years from now? So again, as I said, I'm not a financial advisor. I can't tell you about, I don't know anything about finance. If it's going to impact the way you're going to live today, that it's not the right way to live, then I don't think it's the right thing to be cutting into that. If a person says to himself, I'm not going to spend money as if there's no tomorrow and just buy everything and anything, I'd rather put it away, so that person's being prudent. I'm not going to live less. I'm not going to be living below my standard. I'll be comfortable, I'll be happy, everything will be fine. If a person says to himself, a cheshbon, I can afford a house that costs this much money, and I can afford a house that costs much less, and I'll be just as happy. It meets my needs. I'm not going to be an outcast from society. I fit into the society. I blend in. Everything is fine. But I could afford the mansion. If a person says to himself, rather than the mansion, I'll put the money away, that's certainly reasonable. But if it's going to affect the quality of life of himself and his family to create something negative, I don't think that that's where the person should be cutting corners. So obviously there's a huge gray area in this, and I can't answer on the gray area.
How should a Jew approach seeing the country, I'm reading a question, seeing a country he loves, we only have a few more minutes, let me get some, a country he loves and a country which has allowed religious freedom succumbing to fascism? This is a question. That's it. That was the word. That was the question.
You sent it in?
It's supposed to be anonymous.
What's fascism? Have we defined fascism?
What?
He asked what fascism is.
Okay. I don't think it makes a difference with the question. You know, there's a piece in the Meshech Chachma that Rav Meir Simcha wrote. Rav Meir Simcha was Nifter in the 20s, 100 years ago. It's 99 years that he was Nifter. But he wrote a piece in the Meshech Chachma, which, you know, many pointed out as being prophetic, where he spoke about Berlin being the Yerushalayim of Chutz La'aretz, that there was a perception in different parts of Europe that they were basically in a utopian society situation, that things were great and perfect. And we all know that there was Churban. And throughout our history, there were times when Klal Yisrael lived in different countries, and they were at the top of the world, and then there was Churban. Throughout Spain, Portugal, Arab countries, Yidden were mamish from the Chashuvim and then Churban. It's a function of Galus that the Rabbanu Shlalem is doing for us a chesed that we live in the last 60, 70 years in a Medina Shel Chesed where we could function, in a sense, rebuild from the Churban that we experienced, is a tremendous chesed. But it's not a geula. We're in Galus. In Galus means we're living amongst the Goyim. Goyim do not naturally appreciate us. The Gemara says in Shabbos, Sinai is called Har Sinai, Sheyarda Sina La'olam. There's a sinner for Goyim, from Goyim to Yidden, because we are the Am HaNivchar. The details of what's coming out, the truth of the matter is, it's not Yesh Ma'ayin. You know, I had a Talmud of mine, this goes back 40 years ago, was driving somewhere in, Baltimore is below the Mason-Dixon, but he was driving further in the south. He was driving someplace in Virginia. And he pulled in to get gas, and the person said, Jews are not welcome here. No busha, that's what he said. So I said, up north they feel the same. They just don't say it, because they need us and they have advantage. They benefit from us. But the morals of the Goyim and the way they live was never our morals. It happens to be that the behavior of Yidden impacts the world at large, and their standards are affected by our behavior. But the reality is that the way they think and the way they act, it's a chesed from the Rabbanu Shalom that they leave us alone. And there's no question that we live now in difficult times. The sin in Yisrael has come out more greatly. Their hasagas bichlal, the benefits of democracy for Yidden has been that there was less persecution, it was a different society. The ills of democracy are what we see today, because anything goes. I don't want to get off topic, but there are many different movements in the world, in this country and in the world, that not only are they movements that are fighting for their rights, even though in our minds they're totally immoral, but it's to the point that they are really terrorizing the rest of the country, who, because not only are they looking to be accepted, they're looking to become the norm, to the point that they create enormous pressure. You know, whether you have parades and picketing and lobbying, you have plenty of this going on in this country that affects the moral fabric of this country. This is part of the mitzias of Golas. So the reality is, America has been for us a Medina Shel Chesed to allow us to grow and develop, to regenerate ourselves, but it remains, Saif Kol Saif, a Medina where when you have Goyish morals, that's what you have.
We have time for one or one.
Pardon me?
I
don't know if every place, you're in Golas wherever you go. You have to just see what's best for
even
your family.
Even an Eretz Yisrael, he wants to know.
I understand that. You have to be able to live there.
Final question.
Go back to the Parnassa thing about...
I can't hear.
The Parnassa thing. Speak up.
And Parnassa, where it talks about... Pulling talks about living to certain standards. But then, say something... So, I understand if you have a low budget, so then you don't have a champagne diet. But if you go up, you get a promotion and things like that. Is there an Indian to live to that standard or no? I was doing fine on a beer diet.
If the Rabbanu Shalom gives a person money... The Rabbanu Shalom does not want Ashirim to live like Aniyim. So it doesn't have to live like an Ani. However, I can't say something that's Shavu'a Koil, because a person lives in a society, he doesn't want to stand out in the society amongst either his peers or whatever it may be. However, the fact that a person has a tremendous amount of money is a gift from the Rabbanu Shalom with a tafkid. So if he can live nicely and use the money to support Moisdes HaTorah, support Aniyim, do Dvarim Toivim, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave it to him for. It's a Medrash. The Medrash says HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives money to Ashirim as a Pikadim. And if he doesn't use it the way he was supposed to use it, he'll give it to somebody else. And the Medrash says it like this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I gave you the money, gave you a job. You're not Petrupas. I trusted you as an executor. If you don't handle it properly, I'll find somebody else to handle it. So the fact that the person has a lot of money does not mean it was given to him to spend. He should not live like a pauper. He should live according to his station in life. And if a person is an usher, he has to live according to the standards that are becovedic for him. But he should recognize it's an opportunity for him to have schuyais in either Hachzakas Torah, taking care of Aniyim, and it's tremendous. I mean, it's the Gemara Baba Basra. The Gemara says that he said to the children, my father made Eitzris treasure houses of gold and silver. What do you do with yours? So he answered him, I have treasure houses in Olam Haba, because I give away to tzedakah. So that's a tremendous opportunity for a person who has money that he doesn't need for his standard of living.
Someone with
That's a, it's also a Gemara. But the Gemara says that, I mean, the Gemara seems to indicate that a person should think about himself that the schuyas that will accompany him is the schuyas he has of the tzedakah that he gives. I mean, the Gemara uses a very strong lashon about not leaving for the children. I think a person has to think about his children, understanding where they're holding, what their needs are. It may make a nafkamina exactly the ages of the children, what their matzav is, their parnasa. Is the point of the Yerusha just to make them ashirim, or they need it? If they need it, b'sor chal tesalim. A person can give them a certain amount of money even in his lifetime. A person, the shlo cautions a person not to give too much to his children in his lifetime and leave himself a nitzrach that the shlo discourages. But a person should take into account his children's needs. But just simply to leave a Yerusha because that's going to be my legacy, the what he does with his money, with mitzvahs, is a better legacy than the other, if his children don't really need it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Lachlan.